Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So the Clinton campaign is making hay with a statement that Barack Obama made earlier this month in San Francisco when, during a fundraising event, he said, among many other things, it's not surprising then that they get bitter. They cling to guns or religion or antipathy to people who aren't like them, or anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations, talking about people in small towns that are now economically depressed. Well, what could the American worker possibly feel bitter about? Coming up later in the hour, we'll read something kind of similar that Bill Clinton said in the early 90s when he was running for president about the economic fears of Americans in depressed areas. And we'll actually have a call in on whether you think any of this matters and try to put it in a larger context of the campaign being about the campaign at this point on both sides. But first, Stephen Greenhouse is here. He's the labor and workplace reporter at the New York Times, and he's got a new book out called The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Hi, Stephen Greenhouse. Welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be here, Brian.
When you heard Obama's comments, in or out of context, did you think, wow, this is my book?
Oh, boy. I thought they were not the wisest comments on his part, but when he talked about how people in, you know, small industrial towns that have lost a lot of factories and a lot of jobs are feeling bitter, I thought, well, that's a point I make in my book. Bitter might not be the best word. I think angry, frustrated would probably have been better words.
Angry, frustrated at whom in your reporting?
They're in part frustrated at the companies that closed the factories. They're in part angry at Washington for not doing more, for not lifting a hand to help preserve manufacturing in the United States. They're bitter, angry, frustrated, all of the above, wisely or unwisely, fairly or unfairly, against free trade pacts, which many industrial workers, laid off industrial workers, see as helping destroy American jobs.
You write in your book that, quote, globalization used to hurt just the Bud crowd, but now it is also hitting the Starbucks crowd. So let's talk free trade.
Well, in the 80s, and I was once a reporter in the Midwest in the 80s, I covered a lot of plant closings, steel plant closings, machinery plant closings. And we're seeing a lot of manufacturing closings through today. Over the past, well, since the year 2000, the nation has actually lost one-fifth of all its manufacturing jobs, which is an amazing amount, and it's something that hasn't been discussed enough. We've lost 3.5 million manufacturing jobs that have often served as pathways to the middle class for many workers who don't have college degrees. Now, we've been seeing in the past 5-10 years, you know, the switch from globalization trade hurting the Bud crowd to hurting the Starbucks crowd. We've been seeing a lot of good white-collar jobs, a lot of high-tech jobs go to India, go to the Philippines, increasingly to China. Some are going, you know, Boeing has moved some engineering jobs to Russia. Some accounting firms have moved jobs to the Philippines. In my book, I talk about a woman in Seattle, Myra Bronstein, who was a software engineer, and she worked for several years at a software company. And she was told, as long as the company's doing well, as long as you work hard, don't worry, you'll have your job. And then, boom, one day the company, you know, told Myra Bronstein is her name, and 17 other engineers, you're fired. And guess what? If you want to receive any severance pay whatsoever, you have to spend your next 4 weeks training the workers from India who will be replacing you.
Ouch. And so, yeah, that'll make you bitter.
Some workers are bitter. I think bitterness sometimes turns to anger, towards frustration, towards, you know, political activism, sometimes to resignation.
And in a way, the reference in the Obama quote to anti-trade sentiment was the most interesting part of that to me. Because it's not new to say that people in, you know, small towns who are that are economically depressed might be too focused on social issues or blame immigrants or whatever when their real concerns are should be economic and voting on the basis of economics. I mean, Democrats have been using that line for a long time. But Obama included that particular piece of economic policy, saying it's not surprising then that they get bitter. They cling to this or that or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations. But he himself, as has Senator Clinton, have been skeptical of free trade or trade agreements the way they've been practiced in this country in recent years. And so I wonder if you can take us a bit deeper into the candidates' real positions on free trade. Why would Barack Obama kind of dismiss anti-trade sentiment as something maybe a little bit illegitimate when that's been part of the stock and trade of his campaign as well as Senator Clinton's and the Democratic Party's?
It's very hard to parse exactly what Senator Obama meant. I don't think he was saying that anti-trade sentiment was illegitimate. I think you're saying that a lot of anti-trade sentiment, a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment stems from, he used the word bitterness, I would use the word unhappiness, frustration about the economy. I would imagine, you know, if the unemployment rate were 1% rather than 5.1%, and if wages were galloped upward the past 5-10 years, instead of remaining flat as they have, you know, for the past 5 years, you know, people would not be complaining so much about free trade agreements. People would not be complaining so much about immigrants. So I think, and I have to be very careful here, I think what Senator Obama said, you know, there's a lot of truth to what he said with regard to trade and immigrants. And I think, you know, the proof of that is that Senator Clinton and Senator Obama have spoken out a lot in depressed areas of Pennsylvania and Ohio about the importance of slowing free trade agreements, stopping free trade agreements. You know, they wouldn't be giving those speeches on Wall Street. They're giving those speeches where there are, you know, in small towns and large towns that have lost factories, that are depressed, and where there's huge sentiment against trade agreements.
The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, is the book by New York Times labor correspondent Stephen Greenhouse. We can take some phone calls for him on the larger issue, and we'll do a specific call in a little while on the Obama comments in the context of the campaign at 212-433-WNYC. But for right now, for Stephen Greenhouse and the ideas in his book, The Big Squeeze, 212-433-9692. So in the book, you write that in the United States, it was always assumed that your children would earn more and live better than you do. For the first time, many Americans are worried that their children's generation will actually live worse than they do. Those fears are fully justified. Now, that's a strong statement to say that they're fully justified. What's happening?
What's happening is unfortunate things are happening for young workers, especially young workers who don't have college degrees. And, you know, the Pew Charitable Trusts recently did a study showing that for, you know, the typical male worker in his 30s, that their income is lower than their father's income was a generation ago. You know, other studies are showing that entry-level income for workers in their 20s is actually lower than it was in the year 2000. The percentage, and I spell this all out in my book, the percentage of, you know, again, entry-level jobs that provide health insurance, health coverage, is lower than it was 10 and 20 years ago. And unfortunately, it's the same thing for pension coverage. You know, for workers, you know, between the 20s and 30s who are entering the workforce, they don't have the same good pensions. They're not being part of the same good pension plans that their parents were in. So the picture isn't very good. Now, if you get a college degree, if you get an advanced degree, if you get a nice law degree from Columbia or NYU, you're probably going to do fine. But if you're a worker who doesn't get a college degree or only gets, you know, 2 years of community college, you're probably going to do worse, because a lot of the good manufacturing jobs that were out there 20, 30 years ago that, you know, for which someone without a college degree could make, you know, $20 an hour, those jobs are disappearing. And, you know, in their place are many service sector jobs, you know, Walmart jobs, Target jobs, security guard jobs, janitor jobs that only pay $8, $9 an hour. And it's very hard to climb into the middle class making $8, $9 an hour. It's very hard to support a family. So, you know, one of the interesting things is that the gap, you know, people who 20 years ago, high school graduates generally earned 40% less than college graduates. Now the premium is 76%. So it's very important to go to college now if you want to
make ends meet. Yeah, and another example of the squeeze is right on the in the lead story of the Times today. Did you see Gina Colada's story? Co-payments go way up for drugs with high prices. Insurers shift burden. And who are they shifting the burden to? They're shifting them to us so that they're now charging patients a percentage of the cost of certain high-priced drugs instead of a flat fee like $10 or $20, usually 20 to 33%, which can amount to thousands of dollars a month, the article says. And she writes, the system means that the burden of expensive health care can now affect insured people, too. Which brings in the question, the whole meaning of insurance, or health insurance in particular, for employed people in this day and age, Stephen.
Absolutely, Brian. The story today was scary. And it kept saying, well, employers and insurance companies are foisting more of prescription costs on people who get these rare drugs for rare diseases. And they're doing that to save money just for other workers. I suspect they're also doing it to save money for the insurance carriers and the companies. And, you know, one of the main points I make, you know, from researching my book and writing my book is that, you know, companies are looking every which way to try to, you know, save money with regard to their workforce. You know, wages, unfortunately, have been stagnant for the average worker over the past 5 years. As we all know, unfortunately, health benefits have been getting worse. Premiums, employee premiums for family coverage have actually doubled in the past 7 years, and the average worker has to pay $1,600 more out of pocket for family health coverage than was the case at the beginning of the decade. And, you know, Gina Colada's front page piece today, again, makes the point that companies, insurers are foisting more of costs onto workers.
Jay in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Stephen Greenhouse. Hi, Jay.
Hi, I love your show.
Thank you.
My comment is that I can tell you why children live worse than their parents now. And the reason they do is the crushing costs of education. I had been living under an enormous student loan debt for years and years, not being able to afford a home and what have you. And it was only very recently when I just happened to have some inheritance that I was able to make a sizable dent in it to make it more manageable.
So the cost of education itself. Stephen, you weigh in on that in the book?
Yes, you're absolutely right, and I should have added that. You know, the cost of education for, you know, state colleges over the past 5 years has risen an amazing 40%. And, you know, when, you know, my father got out of the Army and, you know, after World War II, they had the GI Bill. They could virtually go to college for free. You know, state colleges are much cheaper. Community colleges, you know, were much cheaper. And the price of education has gone out of sight. People are borrowing more and more to go to college, and so after they graduate, you know, they're weighed down by college debt. Another big problem is Pell Grants. The value of Pell Grants, you know, which help lower income people go to college, is way down. In the 1970s, they paid for 84% of going to a state university. Now they only pay about 35%. So you're right, the cost of college is really killing a lot of people. You know, one statistic that amazed me is that of the nation's, I think, 146, you know, best, most elite colleges, only 10% of the students there are from the bottom half of society income-wise, and only 3% are from the bottom quarter. And all that makes one worry very much when the United States talks about being a land of mobility and equal opportunity.
So what do you recommend in that sphere in particular, that we pay more taxes so Pell Grants can cover more of the modern cost of a college education, or that professors take lower salaries, or that schools do less research? I mean, do you go there?
I think Harvard, Yale, they've been doing a very smart thing. You know, they have these, you know, humongous endowments with many billions of dollars, and so they've been saying that students from families who make under $100,000, under $120,000. Kids from families under $60,000 can go totally for free.
Right, but I hate to use Harvard and Yale as too representative of much, because they have these big endowments and most schools don't, correct?
Right. That's fair, Brian.
And they're so elite.
Yeah, that's fair. So, for the broader population, Pell Grants, were recently increased by Congress, and that should help, some poor kids afford schools. It would be great, everyone's been wishing for decades that colleges raise tuition slower. That's very hard. But I think the government, we as a people, have to figure out better ways for people to afford college, and there should be extra efforts to hold down the price, especially of state universities. A lot of states, have faced budget crunches. A lot of states have cut taxes, and the way they've helped balance their budgets is raise the cost of state university tuition faster than ever before. And that's also hurt a lot of students.
Ernesto and Tenafly, you're on WNYC with Stephen Greenhouse, author of The Big Squeeze. Hi.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
Stephen, listen, I heard you say that if unemployment goes down to 1%, then maybe wages would go up. But from everything I read from reliable sources like The Economist, 4% unemployment is basically no unemployment, because that 4% are people transitioning between jobs or between careers and whatnot. So I think you've set up a straw man here.
Oh, okay. Far be it for me to argue with The Economist. I think, without getting too technical, there's a debate about what full employment really means. I think a lot of people would say full employment is more down around 2.5%, 3%. I was probably exaggerating when I said 1%, and I apologize for that. But a lot of Americans have dropped out of the workforce because even with the unemployment rate, fairly low by historical standards, 4% or 5%, it's hard to find jobs. It's hard to find good paying jobs for a lot of people, again, especially people without college educations. So even though the unemployment rate is pretty low, there's a lot of softness in the job market. A lot of people have gotten frustrated and given up. So when I was talking before about, people feeling frustrated, people in the Midwest, in towns that have lost jobs, that they're feeling frustrated, and that has turned them against trade pacts, that has turned them against immigrants, I think that's true. Maybe I should have talked a little more precisely that, in pockets of the nation where there might be 8, 9, 10% unemployment, if unemployment there were just 3, 4, 5%, whatever you want to say, what you or The Economist wants to say is full employment, then I don't think we'd see nearly as much opposition to trade pacts or to immigrants.
Ernesto, do you want to come back on that?
No, thanks. That's all I want to say.
Thank you very much. And really, I think your book is much more about people who are employed and what they're facing over the next generation than people who are unemployed.
Yes. Not that many books have been written that really take a close look at, what goes on, in workplaces, in society. Barbara Ehrenreich did a wonderful job in Nickel and Dimed. David Shipler did a wonderful job in The Working Poor. And I, having been labor reporter here for a decade, have really gotten a pretty good view of what goes on in many different workplaces. And I thought I wanted to tell the story of, what it's like, working in a Sam's Club and being locked in at night. What is it like working in Toys R Us and, having your manager, erase hours from your time card right before your eyes. Mm. I wrote about a guy who worked at a Family Dollar discount shop, and he literally had to work 100 hours a week. He'd sometimes work till 1 or 2 in the morning. He was the manager of the place, and he'd actually sleep there.
Why do they do that? I mean, you're right that some managers feel that they have to cheat workers who earn less than $20,000 a year. What pressure are these managers under?
At many companies, Brian, these managers are under huge pressures to, make the payroll, is the phrase, to meet their numbers. Because if they, overshoot their allotted payroll, if they have too many workers working overtime, then, their higher ups could get very angry at them. Sometimes they'll fire them. Often they'll get bawled out. So, we live in society where a lot of managers want to move up in their companies and they want to please the people above them. And if they could manage their store, manage the restaurant without going over their assigned payroll, you know, that's great for them. And if they could even do lower than their assigned payroll, then they look like geniuses, and that might help them, you know, shoot up the corporate ladder faster. Plus, you know, many managers' bonuses are attached to whether they meet payroll, whether they come in under payroll. So there are huge incentives for managers to cut all sorts of corners in how they handle their workforce.
And I should mention before we run out of time that you do refer to exceptions. High point companies like Costco and Patagonia and Timberland, even some hotel casinos in Las Vegas, as taking the high road in this area. But last thing, one commenter on our webpage asks, could globalization of labor unions help? For one thing, he writes, a union could follow a U.S. company's move overseas. Is that realistic?
Ideally, globalization of labor unions could help, but labor unions are having such a hard time getting their act together just domestically that it's, you know, I think it'll take, you know, at least 10 or 20 or 30 years for global unions to really become effective. I think they might be effective in certain, you know, fights and certain struggles, but, you know, globally, across the board on many issues, raising wages in many countries at the same time, I think we're a few decades away from that happening.
Even though they all have the name International Brotherhood of whatever in their titles, they're not very international. All right, my guest has been New York Times labor and workplace reporter Stephen Greenhouse. His book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. It officially comes out tomorrow. You can read it in line at the post office while you're waiting to mail your taxes. Thanks a lot for coming on, Stephen.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
And we'll come back to those Obama and 1991 Bill Clinton quotes about squeezed Americans in a minute. Stay tuned.